Netanyahu, who the International Criminal Court prosecutor, Karim Khan, is now seeking indictments against for war crimes in Gaza to address a joint session of Congress.
Yeah, I'm in complete disbelief. I'm horrified by that invitation. I can't believe we are doing this. When you think about it, when I think about my Palestinian constituents, my Muslim constituents, my constituents who stand up for justice and humanity, who have been fighting to end this genocide in Gaza, what we see is the continued, not just ignoring, but dehumanization of Palestinian people by inviting Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress. We are stating to Palestinians that your lives do not matter. Your lives are less sacred, less precious, and less valuable than other lives, particularly the lives of those Israeli lives. And it's particularly disgusting because most of the people who have died in Gaza, been killed in Gaza, are women, children, and babies. I can't believe we're inviting him here right now.
Democratic Congressmember Jamal Bowman represents the 16th Congressional District in New York, which represents a number of parts of Westchester, including Mount Vernon and Yonkers. Congressmember Bowman, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a $4 billion spending plan. Will it help Multnomah County provide more assistance for the houseless and solve an ambulance crisis? The tragic cases of murdered and missing Indigenous people are hitting home in Oregon's communities. And a heat wave is about to hit. How to make sure you are ready for it. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 6, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Multnomah County's leaders and staff met for hours today, hashing out their final plans on a budget for fiscal year 2025.
It's a math problem, not advanced calculus. This is first grade math. We just need more. We need more ambulances. We divide the number of paramedics, and we can staff all of our ambulances in 3 months.
We have to remember we also have an ambulance services contract, a county code, and then an active contract.
I think there's been a fair amount of patience from county residents of, like, we're going to try and resolve this. The fines were the first step.
The spending plan totals almost $4 billion, with an emphasis on houselessness and drug treatment programs. We're about to see the hottest weather so far this year. Temperatures could get into the mid-80s tomorrow. The higher temperatures mean more risk of wildfires. Experts say it's a good time to make sure you've got an emergency safety kit and plan.
2-3 weeks supply of food and first aid kit, of course. If you have any pets, like leash and food for them, or a kennel or some way to contain them because they get scared. For kids, comfort items because they'll be scared. Things that make them feel safe and comfortable, activities to keep them distracted. For those that need some assistance, if they need walking devices, or make sure you have those assistive devices available for them. It seems daunting and it's a lot, but you can start small and go from there. But we encourage everybody to do that. And then I want to talk a little bit more about how many have land here or yards, and how many have practiced defensible space. Really, it is creating a space around your home that makes your area and your environment more resistant to fire, and that really can help mitigate protecting your home against a wildfire. So we encourage you to be the eyes in your neighborhood and report anything that you may see that could be a hazard.
The tragedy of missing and murdered Indigenous people is impacting Oregon, including some of the younger generation. At a town hall in Umatilla County, Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley answered this question.
Abigail, welcome. Sixth grade, Sunridge Middle School.
My question is, how are you guys, like, handling missing, murdered people and missing, murdered Indigenous woman. How are you guys handling that? And how are, like, the families when the mothers and people, when they go missing, the families don't know how to handle that, and they'll just need help for people to come and comfort them, our family, and help them understand that, get them to understand that they're missing. And what is your role?
We have had a specific conversation about this, and there is a federal act that I'm pretty sure is now passed that provides a lot more funds for the investigation for the FBI as our federal police force to work with the local police to put a lot more spotlight on this and work in partnership also with tribal governments, because often that you need tribal collaboration for law enforcement on tribal reservation land and so forth. It has been very effective to have many members of the tribal community raising the issue, and including when I first saw tribal members.
And this week, our country's lawmakers are focusing on reproductive rights, and a Pacific Northwest senator is one of the primary leaders and voices. Washington Senator Patty Murray described the current status of the right to reproductive care, including abortion, at a hearing.
We take a close accounting of the trauma Republicans are inflicting on women and families across our country, and the damage they are doing to basic reproductive health care through their horrific anti-abortion crusade. The issue here is simple, and it cuts to the core of American values, freedom. Many women every day experience the joy of becoming pregnant and raising a family. They were able to make that decision for themselves. But no woman, no one should be dragged through a pregnancy against their will. But right now in America, more than a third of women of reproductive age live in states where they essentially do not have the choice to end a pregnancy if they need to. Instead, Republicans have made the choice for them with extreme abortion bans and cruel restrictions on access to care. With these policies, they have told women in no uncertain terms, you don't control your body, we do. That is horrifying. Think about what it means, what it really means to be told someone else can decide you have to stay pregnant, no matter the circumstances. Think about how little power that gives a woman over her own life and her own health. And think about how much power that gives not just politicians, but any man who knows he can get a woman pregnant, force her to stay pregnant, so he can have control over her or even get revenge for the rest of her life. To every Republican who hopes this issue will go away, or is hoping the post-Dobbs reality will become settled status quo, listen, you never forget and you never just get used to someone else taking control of your body, your medical decisions, your plans for your family, or your future. You never forget a politician rescinding your right to make decisions about something as personal as your own pregnancy and imposing his will instead, especially when you live with the consequences every day. And the consequences of the post-Dobbs abortion bans are so much broader and so much more devastating than any one story or hearing can ever do justice. There are stories that get a lot of attention that are shocking almost beyond belief. Stories of women denied care for a miscarriage because of abortion bans. Women turned away from hospitals because their doctors' hands were tied, until they lost over half of their blood, until their husband found them unconscious, until the only option was an emergency hysterectomy, or tragically, until it was simply too late. Or stories of children who can't get abortion care after being raped. Some kids may be able to get across state lines to get the care they need. Other children have been forced into motherhood by Republican politicians. These nightmares are happening across our country as a direct result of Republican abortion bans. And there are so many other stories that go untold. Women who do not want to be pregnant for whatever reason, maybe they can't afford to have another child right now. Maybe they are in an abusive relationship. Maybe they just don't want a kid right now, period. But they are told by politicians they have no say in the matter. not unless they have the time and resources, often thousands of dollars, to travel, in some cases, hundreds of miles. We live in a reality where forced pregnancy has become so widespread and so rampant that only the most dystopian stories get national attention. A forced pregnancy does not have to make headlines to make someone's life a living hell. And let's be clear about a few more things before we get started. Republican attacks are not only hurting people in the states where they banned abortion, they are not only hurting women who need an abortion, and their attacks on our rights are not stopping at an abortion. When it comes to states like mine where abortion is legal, providers are being stretched beyond capacity by women in desperate need of abortion care they can no longer get at their home. So when it comes to women who aren't even seeking an abortion, bans are hollowing out health care for women in general, especially for those who already face some of the biggest challenges getting care, women of color, indigenous women, those in rural communities. Because, in a surprise to no one, health care providers do not want to work in states where politicians get between a doctor and their patient and threaten providers with jail time and the loss of their medical license if they dare to help patients get the care they need. In states with extreme abortion bans, we are seeing healthcare providers closing their doors and shutting down their practices, new doctors staying away, and fewer options for patients to get a whole range of necessary healthcare services. And when it comes to what is next, Republicans have already made it painfully clear they want a national abortion plan. Look at how many Republicans have co-sponsored national abortion bans. Look at the Life at Conception Act. That is a bill that is supported by more than half of the House Republican Conference that would enshrine fetal personhood nationwide. It would mean that women and doctors will be charged with murder for an abortion, making them eligible for the death penalty in their states. It would mean emergency contraception, like Plan B, outlawed. And it would mean IVF ripped away from people who are trying to start a family.
Republican Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy countered Senator Murray.
Louisiana's pro-life law was written by a female Democratic state senator and written and signed into law by a Democratic governor. And that female Democratic state senator was reelected with wide margins. So there is a breadth across the political spectrum of people who have a different way of framing this. My Democratic colleagues want you to think that Republicans believe terrible things. They'll attempt to normalize a decision to abort a child. But a Republican would say that you can't normalize a procedure, at least this Republican, in which the intent is to end a life. Because anyone say that child is not a life? How could you not? I'm a doctor. I see that you have to take care of that mama. But you have to recognize that there is another life there as well.
The senators also heard from a woman who struggled to find an abortion provider.
2 years ago, during my senior year at the University of Houston, I had come out of a two-year-long relationship. After a couple weeks of nausea, not sleeping, or eating, I took a pregnancy test. At one point, I had 5 tests in front of me, and there was no disputing I was pregnant. This was just 2 weeks after the Texas abortion ban, known as SB 8, went into effect, banning abortion after 6 weeks. I knew almost immediately that abortion was the right choice for me. I called and got an appointment at the local Planned Parenthood, just 5 minutes away from me, for later that week. I thought I was early enough to be able to get my abortion that week, but at my appointment, my pregnancy measured 11 weeks. I was shocked. I couldn't get an abortion in Texas. I called 20 different clinics. I called surrounding states and even as far as the Dakotas. No one could see me right away. The earliest I could be seen was 2 weeks later at Jackson Women's Health Organization in Mississippi. This was before the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health decision that would take away the federal constitutional right for abortion. And before 20 more states would ban abortion. And before wait times in states that didn't have bans would stretch longer and longer. My dad took off work and we drove a total of 720 miles round trip and spent 13 hours on the road. We spent 5 hours in a hotel trying to sleep before my first appointment, just to turn right around and go back home. Because of unnecessary restrictions on abortion care in Mississippi, I would have to make the trip all over again as a college student who took out multiple student loans and was counting every penny. I had to pay for my first appointment in Houston, my first appointment in Mississippi, and the abortion itself. Then gas and a hotel for the first trip, and then flights for the second trip. I missed 20 hours each of work and a mandatory internship for my school, a total $2,850. There is no dollar value I can put on the stress of managing everything, the despair of having to go to such lengths for basic health care that was legal just weeks before I needed it, the gut-wrenching reality of having to disclose something so personal to my boss, professors, and anyone in a position of authority for fear of losing my job, failing every class that semester due to all of the class time and assignments that I was forced to miss. I felt so much anger that the politicians in Austin thought that they had the right to make this decision for me. I am one of thousands of people that have now gone through this.
Doctors also testified that they're struggling to provide care to their patients due to vastly different abortion laws by states across the country. A new report shows rural America's climate impact is often overlooked. Alex Gonzalez reports.
A Rural Climate Partnership report finds that 36% of U.S. emissions are produced in rural America. Maria Dorr is one of the authors and says the emission impacts of rural America are disproportionately large for the population they represent. Emissions are created by the goods and services produced in rural places like electricity that are then sent to urban and suburban communities. For rural communities, that means air pollution, among other environmental damage. She says achieving the nation's climate goals will take a sharper focus on rural areas.
That's why we need rural communities to be the leaders of change for themselves, because solutions will not work if they come from out of state or from the coastal cities. Solutions must be coming from rural communities. And when they do, they can both address climate issues and reduce emissions.
Dorr says rural messengers are critical for communicating the potential benefits of clean energy development, such as new local jobs, as well as opportunities for tax and land lease revenue that can help farms stay in business. She adds, while climate action has been moved forward thanks to the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act, a portion of which have funds stipulated for rural places, the work must continue. Dorr says rural communities have not been prioritized in efforts that would help them harness the benefits of energy efficiency and electrification.
I am hopeful about opportunities to help those rural communities lead for themselves to create changes like bringing in more clean energy projects that create local jobs, that increase grid resiliency and reduce energy costs.
Dorr says rural households spend 25% or just over $450 more annually on household energy than their non-rural counterparts. Dorr says that's due in large part to the energy sources used in more remote places. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, a few passing clouds, down to a low 55. Tomorrow's weather, sunny and hot, up to 86. Today in history, on this date in 1944, the Normandy invasion began as 156,000 troops started the Allies' invasion of northern France from England, the famous D-Day of World War II. The quote of the day is from Dwight Eisenhower. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. We've been coping with West Nile virus now for more than a quarter century, and the weather this year could make it a tougher season. Mike Moen has more on the story.
A mild winter and rainy spring sets the stage for more mosquitoes flying around this summer, and health officials hope long-standing prevention tips still resonate. West Nile was first detected along the East Coast in 1999. The mosquito-borne virus usually does not result in symptoms for infected humans, but serious cases still happen. North Dakota West Nile Surveillance Coordinator Amanda Bakken says the virus is still in boom or bust mode for infections.
We always want to make sure that the population is keeping an eye out for mosquitoes because those swings can happen quite rapidly. And if we do start to have a increase in cases, we don't want that to affect large amounts of our population.
She says it's not exactly clear why peaks in human cases only happen around every 5 years. But there are factors like bird migration patterns because mosquitoes feed on them, setting off a chain of infections. To avoid mosquito bites, you're encouraged to buy bug spray containing DEET, make sure your home's window screens aren't punctured, and eliminate standing water around your property. Federal health and environmental officials have looked at how climate change and West Nile overlap. Mockin says one way is extended droughts.
Those hotter and drier environments can really push mosquitoes and birds into concentrated areas for water sources. And in those circumstances, we can start to see an increase in West Nile cases.
And while most people infected aren't symptomatic, Mockin says you still want to avoid these situations or spreading it to vulnerable populations. She points to research about the health impacts.
There can be very long-term effects associated with a West Nile infection. I'm talking years to a decade of having lingering symptoms.
And some of the rare serious symptoms include muscle weakness, vision loss, numbness, and paralysis. This is Mike Moen.
Former President Trump says his political rivals could face prosecution. Senate leaders say the U.S. is highly vulnerable to election disinformation. And Arizona voters will decide whether local police can arrest undocumented migrants. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
It's a terrible path that they're leading us to, and it's very possible that it's going to have to happen to them.
Former President Donald Trump says his political rivals could face prosecution as payback for his recent felony conviction. He says only his self-restraint kept opponent Hillary Clinton out of prison, but if elected, he'd send a special prosecutor after President Joe Biden. In spite of comparisons with authoritarian regimes, House Speaker Mike Johnson says he'll use congressional oversight to target legal actions against Trump. With just 5 months until the election, Senate leaders say the U.S. may be more vulnerable to foreign election disinformation than it was in 2020. Virginia Senator Mark Warner says artificial intelligence, oversight failures by tech firms, and Americans' willingness to fall for conspiracy theories are a bad combination.
We got enough disagreement between Americans. The last thing we need is a foreign government trying to exacerbate that.
Last year, YouTube, which is owned by Google, reversed its policy banning videos which argue the 2020 election was a fraud. The Arizona legislature has given final approval to a ballot measure asking voters to make it a crime for non-citizens to enter the state illegally through Mexico. Republican State Representative Barbara Parker says it's about security.
This is not about a race or any race. This is about crime. The crime of crossing an international border when you are not allowed to do so.
The measure would let state and local police arrest those suspected of crossing the border illegally and give state judges the power to deport them. Opponents say it could lead to racial profiling. Common Cause Indiana says a new state voting law creates barriers for marginalized groups who want to use absentee ballots. Executive Director Julia Vaughn says public records requests reveal hundreds of applications in just two counties have already been rejected.
This was the new law that requires people who are registering to vote by mail to include their voter ID number. The problem is your voter ID number could be one of three different numbers.
A new poll finds young rural voters remain the most uncommitted and least contacted by political operations. Emma Frederick, an organizer with Leaders Igniting Transformation, says rural college students in particular feel overlooked.
They note that this is the first time that anyone's talked to them about voting. And while their parents might want to help or their parents don't know themselves, this is a new experience for them.
Frederick says a top issue for young rural voters is the lack of funding for their hometown school districts and a decline in advanced high school classes. Healthcare, reproductive rights, and climate issues are also top concerns. I'm Catherine Carley.
A Wisconsin tribe aims to compile a full list of those taken to boarding schools, and the Mending Broken Hearts program helps families through the addiction crisis. For these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Chippewa community in Wisconsin hopes to have a full list of all tribal children forcibly taken to Indian boarding schools in the 19th and 20th centuries. Compiling that list and providing answers for current tribal members could take years, but it has started, as Ben Meyer reports for WXPR.
As part of an attempt to force the assimilation of Native children into white culture, the United States government operated or supported 408 boarding schools, largely in the last decades of the 1800s and first decades of the 1900s. At least 10 of those schools were in Wisconsin. But records of the schools and what became of the children who attended them are shoddy and haphazard. Michael LaRange is the tribal historic preservation officer for the Sacagan Chippewa community.
So they were not considered Native enough to fit back into the community, and they weren't essentially white enough to fit into society outside of some subservient roles.
The tribe has started the long process of trying to identify all tribal children who attended boarding schools. It has now digitized the records of Wisconsin's Catholic boarding schools, which were housed at Marquette University. LaRange and volunteers still must painstakingly find, review, and sort the records of other church-operated and federally operated schools, searching for Sacagan children. LaRange anticipates they will find some somber results.
The writing's on the wall. I think it's pretty clear based on the what's happening or what happened already in Canada that we are going to identify unmarked grave sites at some of these boarding schools and then have to deal with how do you move any of those individuals? Can you identify them by person?
In the last 3 years, the likely sites of unmarked graves were located at dozens of Indian boarding school sites in Canada. In the United States, the records are so scattered that LaRange cannot even guess how many Sacagan children were taken to boarding schools or how long his work will take. That work may bring some closure to families and heartbreak to others.
It's a path forward, but it's a path forward to some sad news.
For National Native News, I'm Ben Meyer.
The White Buffalo Recovery Center helps Native community members who are recovering from addiction and is launching a new family-oriented program in June. It's a version of Mending Broken Hearts, a bi-monthly 3-day workshop that provides culturally informed healing from grief, loss, and intergenerational trauma. The new iteration of the program is open to teens and their parents or guardians. Luke Brown is a peer specialist and will help run the first workshop. He says the hope is that families can heal together.
Mending Broken Hearts itself is an effort to help resolve unresolved grief and to complete some incomplete relationships. It helps us to look at where our trauma has stemmed from. A lot of it is from historical trauma, from colonialism.
The center offers clinical support and other services run by peer specialists, including drum sessions, recovery support meetings, and a 12-step Medicine Wheel program. It's based in Arapaho, Ethiti, and Riverton, Wyoming, and serves enrolled tribal members and tribal descendants. The American Indian Policy Institute at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University and the National Congress of American Indians has announced the launch of the Center for Tribal Data Digital Sovereignty. The center is dedicated to providing tribal governments and communities with resources and support needed to establish a digital sovereignty plan, which includes managing their own data. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We've got wordplay and city names. For more, we go to Pearl Stark from KPOV Bend with the Point Puzzle, a weekly radio puzzle challenging listeners with words and logic.
Last week, I asked you to send me 4 words for structures that you might find in a yard, one each containing the letters W, X, Y, and Z. There are many answers for W, Y, and Z. For instance, swing set and awning for W, little library, apiary, walkway for Y, gazebo and brazier for Z. And for X, we all agreed on sandbox. Our winners this week are Wendy and Barry Hurwitz, who stream KPOV from Newton, Massachusetts.
We build sand castles in the sand.
For the new puzzle, tell me what the following cities have in common: Mobile, Nashua, Charlotte, and Eugene. So again, what do the following cities have in common? Mobile, Nashua, Charlotte, and Eugene. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, spare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Okay, where you been?
I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota.
This has been Tal Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of June 3rd. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 6, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Alex Gonzalez and Mike Moen. The producer's Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest and KBOO News in Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Six election